He returned to Ephraim, who had managed to climb to his feet and was leaning against the SUV on shaky legs. Jack dropped to his knees beside the rear tire and began probing the dirt.
"What are you looking for?" asked Ephraim.
"My bullet." The other one was gone, either in Mullah's leg or lost in the trees on the other side of the road. It took 2 minutes, but Jack finally found the bullet's impact point. He got out his multi-tool, pried the bullet free, and dropped it into his pocket. He stood and faced Ephraim.
"Give me your wallet."
"What?" "Your wallet, and your passport and cell phone." Frowning, Ephraim dug into his back pocket and handed Jack a Belgian passport and a slim brown leather wallet containing a few credit cards, an EU driver's license, and one from Belgium. Ephraim Lickel.
"Are you robbing me?"
Ephraim asked, handing over his cell phone. Despite it all, Jack couldn't help but chuckle.
"No, I'm not robbing you. Where are you staying? What hotel?"
The Embassy Suites in Old Town."
"Room?"
"412.
"Go straight there," Jack said, handing back Ephraim's wallet and passport. "Wait for me." On Ephraim's cell phone, Jack navigated to the address book, found the phone's number, then typed it into his own cell phone.
"Why should I trust you?"
asked Ephraim, taking the phone back.
"Because you're still alive."
"Good point.
What are you going to do now?"
"I don't know. Can you tell me anything about that guy? His name, where he's staying?"
"No, I was just following him."
Jack wanted to ask the obvious question, why, but instead said, "Can you get to your room without going through the lobby?"
"Yes."
"Do that. Get on the 495, find a gas station bathroom, clean yourself up, and then get into your room and stay there. Don't answer the door until you hear my voice." Chapter 10. Alexandria, Virginia. Jack sprinted back to his car and 5 minutes after sending Ephraim on his way, was heading down Cardinal Drive. He crossed over the 495 and onto the Georgetown Pike. At the first stoplight, he spotted a gas station. He pulled into a parking spot. He had one shot at this, he knew, and it was 50-50 at best. Despite taking a bullet from Jack's Glock, Mueller had been moving at a decent clip through the trees, and the man had already proven himself cool in a crisis. Therefore, Jack had to assume Mueller had tended to his wound, regrouped, and either was lying low in the nature preserve or was already out of the area. The question was, would the man go back to his hotel, or did he have a fallback exfiltration plan? Things had gone very bad for Mueller. There were witnesses, and he'd been in a firefight. How would he react? He dug the fast food receipts out of his pocket, then used his phone's Yelp app to map both restaurants. Each was located within a quarter mile of the other, off Richmond Highway. Next, Jack dropped a pin on the app's screen and searched for nearby motels. There were three within walking distance of the restaurants, a Holiday Inn, a Days Inn, and a Comfort Inn, all similar to the hotel Eric Weber had chosen, mid-priced, nice, but not extravagant. Maybe that meant something, maybe not. The outcome of Jack's scheme depended on human nature. Most people looking for a quick meal in a strange city chose restaurants close to their motel. Whether a man like Mueller would allow himself such a convenience, Jack didn't know. But it was all he had. He'd already made one mistake by leaving his passport in the Malibu. Perhaps he'd make another. A common problem with professionals of any trade is self-assurance, the mother of complacency. It had happened to Jack before, perhaps as recently as the supermercado. Even John Clark had once, just once, over a few beers, admitted his own occasional tradecraft blunder. The question was, what do you do after the mistake? What would Mueller do after his? Jack pulled out of the gas station and got back on the highway. 20 minutes later, he reached Richmond Highway, turned south, then took the first exit. He chose the first motel he came to, the Holiday Inn, pulled in, and parked outside the lobby. Inside, using what he hoped was a decent German accent, He gave the name Stefan Müller to the front desk attendant and claimed he was a bit confused. Was he staying here? The answer was no. Jack moved on to the second motel, the Days Inn, and got the same results. At the third motel, he got lucky.
Yes, sir, you sure are, the young Hispanic man said. Can I help you with something?
Yes, please, Jack said, rubbing his eyes. It has been a long day. I have been lost much of the time, and now I realize I have left my key in my room.
I'm sorry to hear that. Do you have a driver's license or passport?
Jack handed over Müller's passport. As the attendant studied it, Jack said with a sheepish chuckle,
About the beard, please do not ask. My wife is only now forgiving me.
Jack held his breath. Sans beard, Jack's appearance was close to that of Müller's. Whether it was close enough now depended on the attendant's observation skills. The attendant laughed.
I hear you. Just a moment, please. I'll be right back.
The man disappeared through a door behind the desk.
2 minutes, Jack thought, half imagining the attendant already on the phone with the police.
Any more than that and he'd leave. The attendant reappeared. He handed back Müller's passport along with a new key card.
Here you go. Let me know if you need directions or a map.
Thank you very much.
Jack started to walk away, then turned a short circle as though trying to get his bearings.
My room is 125, out through the door you came in, then left down the side of the building.
Jack thanked him again and left. He parked his car 4 stalls down from Müller's room and shut off the engine. The room's window curtain was parted about an inch. Through the gap, Jack saw a faint yellow light. He checked his watch. 45 minutes had elapsed since Müller had fled the preserve's parking lot. If he'd had an accomplice waiting at the preserve, he could already be back in his room. Otherwise, his options were to hitchhike or call a taxi. He wouldn't risk the former, Jack decided. Taxi, then. Which meant he was probably ahead of Müller. If he was coming back here, Jack's lead was very slim.
Jack's question from earlier popped back into his mind. Did he snatch up Müller or try to track him?
He reached the same conclusion. Track him. Jack had to assume that unless Müller was working for himself, he'd already reported the incident up his chain of command, regardless of whether he'd recognized Jack at the preserve. With Müller wounded and on the run, he would be hypervigilant for any sign of pursuit. Jack thought it unlikely he could maintain a one-man surveillance of Müller without being spotted. That left him with one option. Track the man remotely, passively.
So many ifs and maybes. Too many.
Without giving himself a chance to come up with more of them, Jack got out of the car, strode toward Müller's door. It was late afternoon, heading toward twilight, and the rain was still falling. Jack glanced around. No one was about. He stopped at Müller's door, drew his Glock, and held it tight against his leg. He took a breath, let it out. He swiped the key card, pushed open the door, stepped inside, then used his heel to force the door shut. He raised the Glock. To his right in the corner, the floor lamp was on. Jack reached back over his shoulder with his free hand and eased closed the door's cross-latch lock.
Hello? Manager, Mr. Müller, Jack called. Are you here? Hello? Manager?
Jack moved now, quickly clearing the front room, then the bathroom and closet. As he'd done in Weber's room, Jack searched the room, taking care to leave everything as he found it. Like Weber's, Müller's clothes were nondescript, either tagless or bought locally at a Target or Walmart. No identification, no airline boarding passes, no scribbled notes or credit card receipts. He turned his attention to the less obvious hiding spots. Inside the chair's zippered cushion or the cover of the ironing board, taped to the underside of a drawer or down the back of the toilet tank. Nothing. He lifted the shower curtain rod free of its wall bracket, gave it a shake, then tilted it downward. From inside the plastic tube came a scraping sound. Jack pulled off the rod's cap and out slid a screw-top aluminum cylinder. He caught it in his palm, then laid down the curtain rod, unscrewed the top, and checked the interior. Bullets. He turned to the sink, closed the drain plug, and dumped out the rounds. They were .22-caliber short bullets, but the tips were coated black. It took Jack a moment to realize what he was seeing. These were Glazer safety slugs, frangible bullets designed to blow rat holes in whatever they struck. The black coating was a polymer cap. Beneath this, the bullet's hollowed-out core was packed with number 12 birdshot. Glazers had devastating stopping capacity, but poor penetrative power. This could have been the reason Muller had chosen to shoot Han in the eye rather than in the skull. Jack picked up one of the bullets. It felt light in his hand. He put it next to his ear and shook it. Not Glazers. In fact, most Glazers came with a blue polymer cap, not black. Here was the answer to the unaccountably soft report of Muller's pistol. Those were containing less propellant than it took to accelerate the round past the sound barrier. Without the sonic crack, all that remained was the explosion of the propellant's gas, and judging by the feel of the one Jack was holding, there wasn't much powder inside the casing. Past 30 or 35 feet, the bullet's trajectory probably dropped like a mortar round, which made Muller's snap shot at Jack all the more impressive. So this was a custom-made frangible. Whether there was a booming business for this kind of ammunition or it came from a niche market, Jack didn't know, but it was worth a check. He pocketed the round. He hoped Muller wouldn't notice the discrepancy. After taking a picture of the loose bullets, Jack wiped them down with a piece of toilet paper, returned them to the cylinder, and slid that back into the curtain rod. He continued his search and struck pay dirt again a few minutes later. Slipped into the folds of the wrapper of a bar of soap, he found a credit card in Muller's name. He photographed it, front and back, then returned it to its hiding place. No second passport. If Muller had one, he either was carrying it or had stashed it elsewhere. If this was the case, the chances were good Muller's exit plan involved air travel and Jack would lose him. If not, Muller would be looking for an alternative route out of the country and would, Jack hoped, use this credit card to make it happen. Time to go, Jack. He gave the room one last quick inspection, saw nothing out of place, then left. Once back in his car, Jack drove a few blocks away, pulled to the curb, and used his phone to log into the campus's Inquester Services portal. He entered Muller's credit card information and toggled the real-time alerts slider beside the entry. He scanned for previous hits on the credit card, but found none. It had never been used. He got back on the Richmond Highway, headed north for 5 minutes, then turned left onto Duke Street. Ephraim's Hotel, the Embassy Suites, sat across the street from John Carlyle Square Park. Jack found a parking spot on a nearby side street and walked the remaining distance. The rain was coming more heavily now, blown diagonally by a cold wind. He ducked under the hotel's awning, then through the lobby doors. He took off his jacket and shook the rain from it, using the time to consider his next step. Whoever Ephraim Lickle was, and whatever his reason for following Muller, the man was a lead Jack couldn't afford to ignore. The downside was he'd be entangling himself with an unknown commodity, which would bring up questions Jack would prefer not to answer. He'd have to deal with them as they arose. Jack walked to the elevators and took one up to the fourth floor. When he got there, he took the right-hand hallway, found room 412, then walked back to the elevators. He pulled out his cell phone and dialed Ephraim's number, and Ephraim answered on the first ring. Jack said, "It's me." "The man from—" "Yes. Are you in your room?" "Yes." "Come down to the lobby." Jack disconnected. He drew his Glock, stuffed it into his jacket's side pocket, and left his hand there. 30 seconds later, he heard a room door click shut down the hallway. Ephraim came around the corner. When he saw Jack, he stopped short, his eyes wide. His hair was wet, probably freshly shampooed. There was no sign of the bullet graze. Ephraim said, "I thought—" "Did you have any trouble getting back?" asked Jack. "No, I don't think so." "Let's go to your room. You lead." Jack followed him back down the hallway to his hotel room.
Stop, Jack said. Look at me.
When Ephraim did so, Jack asked, Is there anyone in there?
No.
Ephraim's reply was immediate, firm. He held Jack's gaze.
Go in first, Jack told him.
Ephraim swiped his key card and stepped inside. Jack followed. He stopped Ephraim at the bathroom door, cleared that, then followed him the rest of the way into the room. It was empty. Jack ordered him to sit down on the bed. Jack pulled the Glock from his jacket pocket and reholstered it. He pulled out the desk chair and sat down. He smiled at Ephraim. The man had been through a lot. Jack needed to put him at ease before he shut down, decided to call the police, or took the first opportunity to leave town.
I'm sorry about all that. How's your head?
Absently, Ephraim reached up and touched the side of his head.
It feels like the mother of all hangovers, but I took some aspirin. It's getting better.
How did you stop the bleeding?
Superglue. I saw it on one of the survival shows.
Any blurry vision, dizziness, nausea, loss of consciousness?
None of those. I'm very lucky, I think.
I'd say so. If you get any symptoms, call me. I'll get someone here.
Okay.
Don't go to the hospital. They'll recognize that wound for what it is.
Yes, I understand.
An awkward silence hung in the air between them. Jack was unsurprised, given the nature of their first meeting. It wasn't as if they'd run into each other at a coffee shop and realized they shared a love of the New York Jets and Aerosmith.
Your English is very good, Jack said.
I spent my third year at NYU. Do you want some coffee or tea?
No, thanks.
Let's talk about what happened. I assume you didn't call the police.
Ephraim shook his head.
Jack believed him.
Interesting. Most people would have dialed 911 the moment Jack disappeared from their rearview mirror.
Having already admitted to following Mueller, Ephraim had just told Jack the pursuit was something he preferred to keep secret.
I am guessing you didn't call them either, said Ephraim.
No.
Listen, Ephraim. If you'd like, we can part company right here, right now. No harm done.
Or we can help each other.
It's pretty clear we were both following the same man.
While this wasn't technically true, it was close enough for now, Jack decided.
Ephraim said, Perhaps so.
I don't know your name.
Jack.
They shook hands.
Jack what? Asked Ephraim.
For now, Jack will do. If Ephraim recognized him, he gave no sign of it. Jack did a decent job of keeping out of the spotlight. Plus, since leaving the campus, he'd cropped his hair, switched to a loosely enforced bi-weekly shaving regimen, and put on 10 pounds of muscle at the gym.
How do I know I can trust you? Asked Ephraim.
Over the last couple hours, we've both had plenty of chances to turn on each other. Ephraim nodded begrudgingly.
There is the whole saving my life aspect, I suppose.
Thank you for that, by the way.
No problem. Ephraim hesitated, then started again.
You know my name. You know I am from Belgium. I'm a journalist, but only freelance right now.
This further complicated things, Jack knew. The last thing he needed was to have his name in the newspapers. America's first son, assassins, and a murder conspiracy with international connections.
I am hoping to, you know, make a name for myself, Ephraim said hesitantly. I just got out of university 3 years ago. I've been working on this story.
Involving Stefan Mueller, Jack said.
If you say that's his name, I believe you. But it's the first I've heard it. I found Mueller through another man I was following, Eric Schrader.
Describe him.
Tall, skinny, short hair, very blonde.
Does that name mean something to you?
Maybe. Go on.
A few days ago, I followed Schrader to a restaurant in Falls Church. That's where he met the other one, this Stefan Mueller. I knew where Schrader was staying, so I decided to take a chance and switch to Mueller, hoping to find out more.
Do you think that's why he shot me?
Do you think he saw that I was following him and lured me to that preserve?
To your first question, probably. To your second, I don't think so, Jack replied. He was there for another reason.
What reason?
Later. Go on.
Anyway, when I went back to find Schrader, I couldn't. He hasn't been back to his hotel. There was someone driving him around, but I lost him. An older man in a white Nissan. I don't know his name, but I have the license plate number.
The recently deceased Peter Hahn. Two of the three people Ephraim Lickel had been following were dead, and he didn't know it.
Tell me about Schrader.
Lickel shifted nervously on the bed.
No, I don't think so. Sorry, I've told you a lot. You've told me nothing. Why were you at the preserve?
Jack had been hoping to get more information before Lickel demanded quid pro quo. He needed to keep both dialogue and his options open.
I was following the man in the white Nissan, Jack replied. I found him through Schrader, who I knew as Eric Weber. How do you know him?
Our paths crossed briefly.
How?
I don't want to answer that, Jack replied. Not yet.
You're a journalist, Ephraim. That's not a bad thing in itself, but the hunt for a story makes journalists do strange things,
especially young journalists looking to earn a name for themselves. No offense.
I understand. But consider this. I know things you don't know, and you know things I don't know. If we share information, we can get further.
Besides, something tells me you are not the headline to my story. Instinct from years of hard-won experience, Jack said with a grin.
Not that, for sure. Genetics, maybe?
What's that mean?
Look into me. You'll have no trouble finding plenty of information. If after that you want to talk, you know where to find me.
If not, Ephraim shrugged.
Well, I've gotten this far on my own. I can keep going on my own.
Chapter 11. Alexandria, Virginia. Ephraim had piqued his interest, but looking into the journalist's pedigree would have to wait a while longer. He had one more stop to make, one that he should have made earlier. He drove back to Rose Hill and circled Peter Hahn's neighborhood, looking for signs of police activity. If someone had found the body at the preserve and called 911, the responding homicide detective would immediately dispatch uniformed police officers to Peter Hahn's home, either looking for further victims or hoping to notify next of kin. Seeing no police cars or anything extraordinary in the neighborhood, Jack turned on to Climb Hill Road. When he reached Hahn's home, he turned off his headlights and pulled to the curb. It was fully dark now, and the rain had slowed to a drizzle that sparkled in the light of the street lamps lining the block. A few houses away, a dog started yipping in the backyard. A woman's voice snapped, "Snickers, get in here!" and the barking stopped. What he was about to do would be damned hard to explain if the police showed up. He hoped it would be worth the risk. After making sure his car's dome light was off, Jack opened the door and climbed out. He didn't look around, but strode up the driveway with purpose, a friend coming to visit his old friend Pete. At least that was the demeanor Jack hoped he was exuding. Jack reached the back door and pulled open the screen, which swung back with only a slight squeal. Jack clicked on his penlight, shoved the end into his mouth, and leaned over to inspect the lock. It wasn't in much better shape than the knob to Hahn's garage had been. Maybe he'd get lucky again. He got out his multi-tool, pried the flathead screwdriver open, then slipped it into the keyhole, wiggling and twisting as he went until finally the tool was halved deep in the lock. Jack started twisting the knob and tool in opposite directions. The first three times he had to back off, afraid his multi-tool was going to snap, but on the fourth attempt, the lock thunked open. Jack poked his head inside and called, "Pete, you here? Hey man, I thought we were supposed to meet up." Hahn wasn't home, of course, and two more shout-outs suggested no one else was in the house. Jack drew his Glock, stepped into the kitchen, and shut the door behind him. He stood in the darkness for 30 seconds, getting a feel for the home. It felt cramped, slapped together in the late 40s, Jack guessed, with narrow hallways and probably a chopped-up interior. When this house was built, the concept of open, flowing floor plans was still decades away. Jack didn't know what exactly he was looking for and didn't want to spend more than 10 minutes inside. It seemed clear to him that Peter Hahn had been a reluctant participant in first the murder of Mark McClune and then in the attempted murder of Jack himself. There had to be a reason he'd participated at all. Jack recalled Hahn's words from the night before. "As it is, I don't know if I've done enough to save her." Who was her? His daughter? It seemed clear she was linked, perhaps unwillingly, to whoever was behind all this. How? Jack walked through the kitchen and stepped into a TV room/nook. Sitting on a rectangular linoleum-topped dining table was a desktop computer. The screensaver was running, tracing colorful expanding lines across the monitor's black face. On the table were disheveled stacks of newspapers, magazines, and Sudoku puzzle books, the kind you find near the register at grocery stores. Lying next to the keyboard was a Windows for Dummies book. It was open to the chapter about emailing and Skype. For safety's sake, Jack walked through the house to confirm he was alone, then returned to the nook and sat down before the computer. He tapped the mouse button. The screensaver disappeared to reveal an open email window and web browser. Jack clicked through the browser's tabs and found a few online crossword and word search sites, the local cable company's TV listing grid, and a page with movie times at the Regal Cinemas Kingstown a couple miles away. Jack opened the browser history and scanned backward. A site title: Impeach President Ryan Now. Jack clicked on the link, which took him to a rant blog dedicated to his father. Jack clicked backward, returning to the history list, and soon found more sites, all dedicated to anti-Jack Ryan ramblings, from complaints about the economy and foreign affairs to conspiracy posts about his father having murdered a woman in Kentucky when he was 12 years old, and his being a secret Chinese sleeper agent. Jack checked the last visited dates and times for each site. All had been visited over the course of 6 days shortly before the attempt on his life at the supermercado. Fallback cover, Jack thought. Eric Schrader/Weber had come at him as a junkie mugger, and he'd gone to some trouble to lay groundwork for the role by panhandling outside the supermercado. If there had been witnesses to Jack's murder, the police would have been looking for a knife-wielding crackhead. If that fell through and Schrader/Weber was somehow tracked back to Peter Hahn, the authorities would find a political nutjob with a motive, albeit a clumsily assembled one, to see the president's son killed. Peter Hahn wasn't crazy. That much Jack felt certain about. Nor did Hahn, who needed a book to work his email, seem like the kind of man to check his browser history. If either Mueller or Schrader/Weber had planted this web history, Hahn would have been unlikely to discover the ruse. Either that, or Hahn himself had visited the sites for the same reason he'd helped Schrader/Weber, under orders, and to protect someone. Jack turned his attention to Hahn's email. There were only a few dozen in the inbox, all of them junk mail or advertisements. He clicked on the trash folders and found more of the same. In the Windows sidebar was a folder labeled BB. Jack opened this and found hundreds of emails dating back 6 months. Jack chose one at random and opened it. "Hi, Dad. I got the book you sent me. It's hilarious. My cat does so many of those things, it kind of freaked me out." It was signed BB. Jack clicked on sender to expand the name. belinda.b.hahn@gmail.com. BB. Peter Hahn's daughter. Securing his little girl's welfare would be leverage enough for any father. Jack clicked on the most recent email from earlier that morning.
Sorry you had to cancel our Skype session today. I was looking forward to it. Before you know it, you're going to be a computer whiz. Anyway, call when you get a chance. Just want to make sure you're taking your meds and all that. I'm also sending you a new Sudoku book. Maybe this one will take a little longer to finish. LOL.
Damn. Father and daughter were in close touch. Until Han's body was found and Belinda was notified, her emails would go unanswered. Jack felt for her. Jack selected the last email, clicked through until he reached the Properties/Details tab, then checked the message's full header, a dense block of text several hundred characters long. Too much to absorb now. Jack inserted his own USB drive, copied and pasted the header into a text document, and repeated the process another 10 times, choosing messages that spanned the duration of Han's correspondence with Belinda. Jack was about to close out the email program when a thought occurred to him. If, in fact, Peter Han hadn't visited these anti-Ryan websites, then someone else had done it for him, either in person or remotely. Jack grouped all the messages in the Belinda folder by file size and scanned down the list. All messages ranged in size from 40 kilobytes to 70 kilobytes, save one, which read as 1.2 megabytes and displayed a paperclip attachment icon. Peter had received it 6 weeks earlier. Jack double-clicked on the email. Beside a thumbnail image of a woman with short, bobbed brown hair, Belinda, he assumed, was the message. Hey, Dad, can you check out my webpage and see if it loads for you? Below this was a hyperlink. This email had all the earmarks of a phishing scam. There was no way the attached thumbnail image was 1.2 megabytes in size. Something else was occupying that space. Jack navigated to the email's properties window, copied the contents to his USB drive, then did the same with the link. Jack called up the browser's history, pasted the link into the search box, and hit enter. There. Han had clicked on the link the same day he'd received it from Belinda. Malware, Jack thought. But to do what? Monitor Han, or to create a false website trail? Or both? And what about Belinda? Was she an unwitting or a witting participant? Jack was back at his condo 30 minutes later. He heated up a bowl of slow cooker chili, grabbed a Heineken from the fridge, and sat down on the couch with his laptop. 2 minutes into his research into Ephraim Lickel, he realized the young Belgian hadn't been exaggerating. Jack kicked himself for having not immediately recognized the name. In Europe, Ephraim Lickel was as close to journalistic royalty as you got, save his mother, who was, it seemed, the undisputed queen of journalism. Marie Lickel, now 64, retired and divorced, had been covering international politics, war, corruption, and legal abuse the world over for almost 20 years longer than Jack had been alive, and had done so across a spectrum of media from radio to television to print. Ephraim, having chosen to follow in her footsteps at an early age, was, as he'd told Jack, trying to make a name for himself, and had apparently been doing so without the largesse of his mother, and by mutual choice, most articles agreed. Both mother and son wanted the heir to the Lickel legacy to stand or fall on his own merits. Unsurprisingly, this struck a chord with Jack. He knew what it felt like to live in a big shadow, and to be anxious to find a way into your own son. No doubt Ephraim Lickel was desperate for the same, while also being keenly and constantly aware he needed to do it better and cleaner than the next guy. Whether that meant Jack could trust him, only time would tell. But did Jack want or need a partner? As had Ephraim, he'd so far made decent inroads on his own. Then again, Ephraim had been working on his story, whatever it entailed, for more than a year. Who knew how much information he'd collected? Jack grabbed his cell phone, scrolled through his address book, and speed dialed a number.
"Alicia Dixon," the voice on the other end said.
"Alicia, Jack Ryan. I didn't know if you'd still be in the office." Alicia was a reporter for the Washington Post. They dated briefly, but it hadn't worked out. Their schedules never meshed enough for them to form a bond, but they'd remained friends, occasionally having dinner or a drink.
"Jack Ryan,"
she laughed. "If it's before 10, I'm usually here. Are you calling to apologize for standing me up?"
"I didn't stand you up, Alicia. I was just very, very late. And didn't I already apologize?"
"Yeah, you did. But I never did see that movie."
"I'll buy you the DVD.
Listen, I need your expertise."
"Shoot."
"What do you know about Ephraim Lickell?"
"The last name I know. Marie Lickell. That's her son, right?"
"Right. Give me the scoop."
"Well, Marie's a legend in Europe. She's won just about every journalism award out there. The Pulitzer, SPJ, Bayou Calvados, Bastian. The woman's got schools named after her, for God's sake."
"No skeletons in her closet?" asked Jack.
"None," Alicia replied. "And believe me, some powerful people have dug into her, especially the bigger fish she's gone after. She's above reproach. When I was at Northwestern, I kept a picture of her taped next to my computer screen. Everyone thought it was Madeleine Albright."
"So you're a fan," Jack said, deadpan.
"If she had a club, I'd be president."
"And what about her son?"
"I've never met him, but rumor is he's just like her. Tenacious, righteous, all that," Alicia said. "He's a little green and maybe a little too eager, but that's more the rule than the exception with cubs."
"Has he cracked anything big?"
"Not really, but I've read some of his pieces. He's solid, got a feel for it."
"Jack, why are you asking? Has Lickell contacted you for something?" Though he hadn't been prepared to answer this question, the lie came easily.
"Not me, a buddy of mine. He just wanted to know if Lickell's a straight shooter."
When had that happened? While he wasn't so squeaky clean, he'd never told a lie. He could remember a time when doing so gave him pause, even a tinge of regret. Lying was a necessity of the job, that he knew, and he had to wonder if Clark and Chavez ever ruminated over it.
"You're thinking too much, Jack."
Alicia replied, "It's a safe bet. Given his family name, one step out of line and the journalism world would know about it, including Mommy. And he knows that, I'm sure. But remember, Jack, off the record only means as much as a journalist's integrity weighs. Tell your friend to assume everything he says is going to end up in the papers."
Chapter 12. Alexandria, Virginia. Jack was up early again the next morning. Having made his choice about Ephraim Lickell, he didn't want to waste any more time. After making a stop at Starbucks, he drove to the embassy suites and was knocking on Ephraim's door shortly before 7. The Belgian answered the door in flannel pajamas. He rubbed his eyes and blinked at Jack. Ephraim was sporting a severe case of bedhead, his shaggy blonde hair flattened on one side.
"I told you not to open the door," Jack said.
"I saw you through the peephole."
"You drink coffee?"
"Copious amounts."
He stepped into the room, handed Ephraim one of the cups, then took one of the seats beneath the window. He parted the draperies slightly to let in some morning sun. The rain had stopped falling the night before, and temperatures were going to reach the mid-70s. Outside, the pavement was already steaming. Yawning, Ephraim shuffled to the table and sat down across from Jack, who said, "I checked into you. You've got some big shoes to fill." Ephraim smiled.
"At least she didn't wear high heels.
Of course, you're living in a shadow of your own, aren't you?
I checked into you as well.
I thought you looked familiar. You don't look much like you do in the official family portrait.
You're a journalist, and pretty good from what I gather. If you're after a juicy story, you've already got one. If you run with what happened yesterday..."
"I'm not," Ephraim said,
taking a sip of coffee.
"Why?"
Will you be offended if I say I'm after bigger fish?
If it's true, no, said Jack. Plus, cliché as it is, you did save my life. What kind of man would I be if I repaid that by feeding you to wolves? There are a lot of your colleagues who wouldn't give it a second thought.
I'm not them, Jack.
You have a saying here, yes? It's not who wins or loses, but how you play the game. My mother believed that, and so do I.
In theory, Jack agreed, but in his business you didn't always have the luxury of being a good sport. In journalism, you certainly had that choice, though it probably tended to make the job much harder.
So what game are you playing? Asked Jack. Are we still quid pro quo?
Yes.
Ephraim took a sip of coffee, then stared into space for a few seconds, as though assembling his thoughts.
Have you heard the name René Almond?
It's familiar.
French soldier, right?
Correct, though he is far from typical. I'll get to that later.
Last year, Almond disappeared from his post, Port Bouet in Ivory Coast. He was there as part of Operation Unicorn, a peacekeeping mission after the Civil War began. Initially, there were rumors he'd deserted, but they were discounted. The consensus is that he was captured by one faction or another, and then executed.
No ransom or video? Jack asked. No one claiming credit?
Not that I've found. And no unidentified bodies in the area that might match him. I've got a couple more leads I'm checking.
You said disappeared. Does that mean he wasn't on patrol at the time? He was on the base?
That's another point of fuzziness, Ephraim replied. I'll come back to that. Anyway, I have reason to believe that not only is René Almond alive, but his disappearance was staged.
For what reason?
Quid pro quo, Jack, Ephraim replied.
Though Jack had already decided to join forces with the journalist, the absurdity of the situation wasn't lost on him, nor were the pitfalls. But nothing was certain in life, was it? A few nights ago, the man you know as Eric Schrader tried to kill me.
Ephraim leaned forward.
You're serious?
Yes. And the man in the white Nissan is named Peter Hahn. Both he and Schrader are dead now.
How?
Schrader walked into traffic and was hit by a truck. Hahn was killed by Müller at the preserve about 10 minutes before he tried to kill you. I was following Hahn.
Go back. Start from the beginning. Leave nothing out.
Jack did this, starting with the incident at the supermercado and ending with his and Ephraim's encounter with Müller at the preserve. He added Doug Butler's revelation about the murder of Mark McClune.
So many questions, Ephraim muttered.
That makes two of us.
Why were they trying to kill you? Why didn't this Peter Hahn finish the job? Why?
Jack held up his hand.
To answer your first question, I have no idea. I've looked at this from all angles. I had a hunch, but that's looking less likely all the time. In all your digging, you never came across my name?
Never.
What about Hahn? What's his story?
Hard to say. He could have killed me twice, and didn't. My guess is he was acting under duress. I also think he went to the preserve knowing he might not be coming back out.
Pardon me?
I think he wanted me there as a witness. I've got some data from his computer. Once I sift through it, we might have a better sense of things.
We.
He had to admit feeling a certain relief having a...
What?
Partner?
Ally?
It wasn't the same as having Dom or Chavez watching his back, but Ephraim Lickel was sharp and, unless Jack's character radar was flawed, trustworthy. And crafty. Ephraim had been swimming with sharks for quite a while and was still alive. He could have worse allies.
I have to say, Jack, you seem very resourceful for a financial advisor.
That's what you do, yes?
More or less. You're good at saying a lot but imparting nothing.
Jack shrugged.
How am I supposed to answer the question?
You're not. It was an observation. I'm curious by nature, too much so if you ask my friends.
Jack, we're going to have secrets from each other, I think. It's inevitable. As long as they don't impact our mutual goal, so be it.
Agreed. Let's get back on track. You were following Schrader. Is that his real name, by the way? When Ephraim nodded, Jack asked, how did you come in contact with him?
Through René Allemand. Or at least I'm fairly certain it was him. He and Schrader met in Lyon, France, in the first week of January.
Jack thought, Lyon, January.
Wait, are you?
Ephraim was nodding.
I believe Eric Schrader and René Allemand met in secret a week before the Lyon terrorist attacks.
Chapter 13. Alexandria, Virginia. Jack had already separated from the campus by the time the attacks occurred, so his only information had come from the media, which had swarmed on not just the similarities to the Paris attacks, but also the timing. Lyon had taken place almost exactly 2 months after Paris. The scale and casualties of the Lyon attacks had been smaller than those in Paris, but both had involved closely timed bomb detonations and mass shootings at restaurants and in the metro. While no group had claimed credit and French authorities had named no suspects, there was no mistaking the modus operandi, which had uniformly been seen as an attempt to rub France's nose in it. Despite all your preparations, we can attack you in the same way, in any place, at any time. In many ways, the Lyon attacks had had a greater impact on the psyche of the French populace and government alike. Jack asked, and you don't think this was a coincidence?
No, said Ephraim. How exactly, I'm not sure, but I think Allemand was involved in the attacks, but perhaps not of his own volition.
What's that mean?
I think he was false flagged.
That's the right word for it, yes? When you're recruited by an enemy posing as an ally?
More or less.
You think Schrader was ultimately pulling his strings?
My guess is no. I think he was simply acting as a handler. For whom, I don't know. Maybe for this Muller fellow. He sounds like a big question mark for both of us. By the way, do you know where he is?
No, but with any luck, we will soon. I'm tracking his credit card. I've got his passport, so he may be desperate for options. Back to Eric Schrader. What can you tell me about him?
German national, age 41, former Feldwebel. First sergeant, I think you would call him, with the Heer.
Jack could guess the rest. He belonged to Kommando Spezialkräfte, Special Forces Command.
Yes,
KSK. How did you know?
Jack told him about the Eichhorn-Solingen knife he'd taken from Schrader. Or more accurately, after Schrader smashed his head into a chunk of concrete and dropped the knife.
Ephraim whistled softly. Have you considered, Jack, that you may be part cat?
Cats land on their feet. So far, I haven't been that graceful. Just lucky. What else do you have?
Two apartments Schrader had visited in the past few months, one in Zurich and one in Munich. The former seemed like a temporary arrangement, I think, but the one in Munich might be his home base.
Munich, Jack repeated. That's where Hans' daughter lives.
No kidding.
What makes you think Zurich was temporary? Asked Jack.
I tracked him there after his first meeting with Allemand in Lyon. The place was luxurious and in a well-to-do neighborhood. Schrader's place in Munich is a far cry from that.
Unless he is slumming, the Zurich apartment belongs to someone else.
Was Schrader in Munich when he left to come here?
Ephraim nodded, and Jack said, At some point, I'll want to see a detailed timeline of all this.
I have one. Great minds think alike.
And I'll want to know how you got from Almong going missing in Ivory Coast to him and Schrader meeting in Lyon.
Of course. We can meet again after you've had a look at Han's emails.
Still quid pro quo. While Jack didn't blame Ephraim for it, he hoped the parrying wouldn't last much longer. The sooner they put their respective puzzle pieces together on a table, the better. However, Jack wasn't confident he could make full use of Han's data. Even the simplest of emails was an alphanumeric stew that made Jack's brain hurt. He could parse only a fraction of the available information, and his go-to expert, Gavin Beery, wasn't an option. He'd have to come up with something else. A thought occurred to Jack.
You said you're working the story freelance. Have you got anyone looking at this?
An editor, you mean?
No one's seen any of it, with the exception of you now.
This is my story. I'm going to deliver it whole.
Who's footing the bill?
I am, through credit cards.
Jack decided to twist the knife a bit, see if he could rattle Ephraim. You're practically Belgian Fourth Estate royalty. No gratuitous allowance? No trust fund?
Not until I'm 30. By then, I expect to have my Pulitzer, Ephraim said with a grin.
Jack, when I graduated from university, my mother gave me a box of red pencils and a card that said, "Edit in good health." So the answer to your question is no. No allowance. Just three nearly maxed out credit cards and a box of red pencils.
Jack laughed. He couldn't help liking Ephraim. Clearly, Marie Lequel and Jack's parents had gone to the same parenting school, the University of Stand on Your Own Two Feet. For Jack, that had meant joining the campus. For Ephraim Lequel, chasing down a story most journalists wait a lifetime to find. The guy had balls, no doubt about it. Jack had to wonder if his getting involved in all this would help or hurt the Belgian. At least three people were dead so far, and Jack had come damn close to being the fourth. If he included the casualties from the Lyon attacks, the tally skyrocketed. The players involved seemed snatched from a grab bag. A missing and possibly traitorous French soldier, a German special forces operator posing as a crackhead, a widowed and lonely man from Rose Hill, and a terrorist group who, despite striking the second deadliest blow on French soil in history, had disappeared from the world terrorism stage.
Then there's me, Jack thought. He was the outlier. Why?
What about you, Jack? Asked Ephraim. Aren't you supposed to have bodyguards or something?
Oh, wait. Is there a helicopter on the roof as we speak?
Jack laughed again.
If there is, it's not for me.
Ephraim finished his coffee, tossed the empty cup into the garbage can beside the dresser.
So what now? Do we keep going together? Or separately?
Jack considered this for a few seconds. I hope I don't live to regret this. But I vote for the former. Ephraim nodded. Seconded. Jack left Ephraim with two chores. One, inspect his rental SUV for any trace of the second round Muller had fired. It was beyond a long shot and would almost certainly turn out to be worthless. But Stefan Muller had in front of witnesses committed murder and attempted murder on a government nature preserve. Jack had an unspent, custom-made bullet from the murder weapon, and if one of Muller's frangibles had embedded itself in Ephraim's SUV, they also had a spent round for comparison. The chances of Stefan Muller seeing the inside of any courtroom were virtually non-existent, but it was an avenue Jack wasn't going to ignore. The second chore he gave Ephraim was to pack his bags and be ready to move within 5 minutes of Jack's call. If he got a ping on Muller's credit card, they'd have to scramble to catch up. When Jack got home, he switched on the TV and surfed the local channels. When he reached WJLA, the Washington area ABC affiliate, A news ticker crawling at the bottom of the screen read, "The man's name has not been released pending notification of family." Jack waited, watching for the story to reappear. A Rose Hill man was found dead at a local nature preserve. The police, who were called to the scene this morning by a hiker, have said only that the circumstances are suspicious. The man's name has not... They'd found Han. Jack hoped it wouldn't take them long to notify Belinda. It was going to be gut-wrenching for her. But better than waiting and wondering why her father wasn't answering his phone or returning emails. Unbidden, an image popped into his head. Han falling back against the bridge railing, sliding down onto his butt, then staring up as Muller lifted the pistol to his eye. Should he have anonymously tipped off the police? Han had sat dead overnight in the rain before being found. It was irrational, Jack knew, but the thought of it set his belly churning. Now the waiting began, waiting for Stefan Muller to pop his head up, waiting for the knock on his door that would answer the question of whether a witness had spotted him at the preserve. At 4:15, Jack's phone chimed. It was a text from Ephraim. The police were here. Jack felt his heart thud against his chest wall. He forced himself to slow down and think. Could they still be there, looking over Ephraim's shoulder, he wondered. Ephraim was a decent guy, of that Jack was certain. But having the police show up on your doorstep asking hard questions about a murder could rattle anyone into submission. Or was this ingrained overcautiousness flavored with strains of paranoia? Jack texted back, and? Ephraim answered, "There had an anonymous tip that my vehicle had been seen in the preserve." Jack had to step carefully. "Go on." "Anonymous tip," came Ephraim's reply. "No one else there. What's that sound like to you?" It sounded like Muller was trying to slow down his pursuers. This was actually good news. If Muller had already left the country, he wouldn't have bothered with the ruse. Ephraim added, "I told them I drove past the preserve, but turned around when I realized I was lost. They seemed okay with it." "Glad to hear it," Jack wrote. "Want to grab a cup of coffee?" Jack gave Ephraim a 20-minute head start, then left the condo, headed west on Wythe Street, and spent 10 minutes driving around the area, watching for signs of surveillance before heading to Washington Street, where he turned left. Out his driver's side window, he scanned the Starbucks parking lot for Ephraim's SUV. It was there, hood pointed toward the street. Jack kept going, looking for a phone booth. A rare beast these days, it seemed. He spotted one on a corner outside a liquor store and pulled to the curb. He dropped some change into the slot and dialed Ephraim's phone. "Do you have anything you want to tell me?" Jack said when he answered. "What? Huh? Think it through." "Oh, I see. I'm alone, Jack. They talked to me for about 10 minutes, then left. You're a source, Jack. Well, more than that, but you get the point. I don't betray sources." "Wait 2 minutes, then go back to your hotel." Jack hung up and made his way back to the Starbucks. Right on time, Ephraim's SUV pulled out of the parking lot onto Washington and headed north. Jack hung back, let a couple cars get between them, then followed Ephraim back to the Embassy Suites. As far as Jack could tell, neither of them was being followed. 10 minutes later, he was knocking on Ephraim's door. Ephraim answered, let Jack in, and shut the door behind him. "Was that all really necessary?" Ephraim asked. "Yes," replied Jack. "Don't take it personally. You're sure you weren't seen leaving the preserve?" "There was no one. When I got to Cardinal, I turned left and headed straight to 495. I didn't see another car until I got on it." "Did the cops mention Han's body?" "No, but I asked. It seems a natural thing to do. I'd seen it on the news and had been near a preserve recently, and now they were questioning me." Jack asked, How did they react?
They didn't. Aren't cops the same everywhere? Stone-faced.
I showed them my professional website, made up some story I was working on about McLean's rapid degentrification, showed them some notes, then asked if I could interview someone about the death. They told me to call the public information office, then left. They seemed annoyed.
Ephraim had handled himself well. He was quick on his feet and not easily shaken. Jack asked, "Is that true? About McLean's degentrification?"
"I have no idea. Is that even a word?"
"Smartass."
Jack hadn't taken two steps back into his condo when his cell phone chimed again, this time with an Inquestor alert. Mueller's credit card had been used to buy $13 worth of gas and $5 worth of grocery items at a Mike's Mini Mart in West Haven, Connecticut. As Mueller hadn't immediately boarded an airplane, it now seemed unlikely he had a second passport. But perhaps he'd stashed a second vehicle.
"West Haven," Jack murmured. "What the hell's in West Haven?"
"Nothing. But due north through Vermont, it was only 5 or so hours from the Canadian border."
Possible, Jack thought.
Vermont shared about 90 miles of border with Canada, much of it rugged and isolated. Jack checked the route from Alexandria to New Haven on his phone's map application. 350 miles, a 6-hour drive. Too long. He got on his laptop and went to a travel website, selected Washington Dulles as the departure point, and chose Hartford as the destination.